I'm gone every possibility. Okay. Practically. Okay. Was it February what?
I think it's
4th. 2010 in Mayapur, and we're going to be talking about the qualities of a devotee, and you all did your homework, right? Because you had so much time yesterday.
Yes, you did.
It was just one of those days where you had nothing to do all day. There wasn't one event going on
No.
or nothing. It was just one of those really easy days, which is why I corrected all the rest of your essays yesterday. Anyway, Rohita, I didn't correct one more yesterday. Rohita has some, I passed out some yesterday. She has some more. God willing, I will finish them tonight, though I might not, because I'm going to Bhanu Swami's lecture again tonight. 4 to 6. So yesterday he gave, in Chaitanya Bhavan, Classroom 1, yesterday he gave an overview of the Bhagavatam in terms of the Vedas. You remember that quick little thing we did with the PowerPoint? Those cute little boxes with the arrows and all that? And you got a paper, too?
Yeah.
You all got a paper. You remember
yes.
that? Yes, Armila, we remember that. Somewhere in all the mountains of paper that we got. So, yeah, so he did something like that. And then he was also explaining the organization of the Bhagavatam. And tonight and tomorrow night, he's going to be, I believe, summarizing first, second, and third cantos. And he really knows what he's doing. He's a real scholar. Oh, thank you very much. Just a reminder that essays are due by tomorrow. Your essays are due by tomorrow. You will have them done. And they will all be very good. They will be done. They will be good. They will be Krishna conscious. They will be well organized. They will be turned in on time, and I will enjoy reading them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Oh, another essay. Anybody else with an essay?
Wow.
And you make sure with essays your names are on them, and you tell me what the essay is about, right? It's about Krishna. Okay, great. Well, I gave a whole little talk yesterday. People turn in essays and you're reading it and thinking, what question are they answering in this essay? What question is it?
Well, I thought it was clear. You should understand.
And you, right away. And you, you know, you maybe it's clear in your head,
no,
but it's got to be clear to me. And I'm looking up the different questions and thinking, does it match any of these? I guess it's one that they picked, but what
yes.
did they pick?
Well, whatever you
My essay is on the Bhagavad Gita, you know. Okay, that really works. Now, it's not funny when you're trying to correct it, and when you're really trying to give people as high a mark as you possibly can, it really isn't funny. You're just like, what do I do with this? Okay, there's got to be something here I can like. All right. So we're looking at, we're not doing 12, 13 through 19. We're looking at 13, 8 through 12, which, by the way, is the same as Ishopanishad mantra. No, 10. Oh, come on.
Yeah, mantra 10.
Why don't we, you know, maybe you don't believe me. So if we look at 10, which I have done, and you go through the 18 things in the purport of text 10 of the Ishopanishad, and if you compare them to Bhagavad Gita 13, 8 through 12, you'll find they're the same list, although they're written slightly differently. So written a little differently. Now, I know I've emphasized this before, but I'm going to emphasize it again, that the list given in chapter 13, 8 through 12 if we turn to chapter 13, 8 through 12, and we find out what this is. So Krishna calls this jnana, and Prabhupada says this process is knowledge, is sometimes misunderstood by less intelligent men as the interaction of the field of activity. In other words, people think that this process is material. Good. But actually, this is the real process of knowledge. If one accepts this process, then the possibility of approaching the absolute truth exists. This is not the interaction of the 24 elements. As described above, this is actually the means to get out of the entanglement of these elements. The embodied soul is entrapped by the body, which is a casing made of the 24 elements, and the process of knowledge, as described here, is the means to get out of it. So this is a process. What's described here is a process. Now, we could also say that these are symptoms of the result, because Srila Prabhupada says here the most important thing is devotional service, and he says if you do devotional service, all the other things will come automatically. We could talk about automatically, that they'll come naturally, right? If one takes to devotional service in full Krishna consciousness, the other 19 items automatically develop within him. And then Prabhupada makes the point about accepting a guru. He said even if you're doing devotional service, because first he said really all you have to worry about is devotional service, then everything else will come. He said, but even then you also should approach a guru in order to do your devotional service properly. So Prabhupada is also saying that these items here are symptoms of somebody who's proficient in devotional service. So they're both the way to achieve liberation, they're the way to achieve perfection, and they're symptoms of perfection. Which is a little confusing, isn't it? How is the way to achieve something also the symptom of having already achieved it? But we find this, we could say, problem constantly in our philosophy. Don't we always find this? In order to be Krishna conscious, you have to do this, but in order to do this, you have to be Krishna conscious. So we find that all the time. So what's the answer to this problem?
The goal is the same as the process.
Well, the goal is the same as the process, which makes things a little confusing. Because sometimes when we're talking about things, we're talking about process, and sometimes we're talking about goal. There is Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Abhideya is the process and Prayojana is the goal. So there is a process and there is a goal. We could say there is a difference between the process and the goal. What's the difference between the process and the goal? Okay, and it's kind of hard to do Krishna Prem to get Krishna Prem. So in what way is the process the goal? In what way is it the same? In what way is it different? The practice stays, or at least very similar.
Well, like, so always, it's always remembering Krishna, never forgetting Krishna. In the beginning, we have to practice it. We have to work at it and try to think of ways to remember Krishna and try to remember his pastimes. And then Krishna Prema, you can't do anything but think of Krishna.
Even before Krishna Prema, even in a Shakti, you can't do anything else but that. Even so, even before Krishna Prema. Yes?
The activities that you perform as the goal are perfected, but you can still perform them as the process in an imperfect state.
In an imperfect state. So there's the external activities are going to be very similar, but what's going to be very different is the consciousness. And of course, some external activities are going to be different. You know, and when you're in the perfected stage, what sort of sadhana is somebody doing what sort of activities, someone in this world, who's at a perfected stage, what kind of activities are they doing that's different than what the sadhaka is doing? Well, that's a matter of consciousness. So that's the same activities, but a matter of consciousness. But they're also doing some different activities.
Maybe the kind of relationship with Krishna is more spontaneous?
It's not only more spontaneous, it's also more... realized, it's more specific. So if you ask a sadhaka, what's your relationship with Krishna? You'll say, well, I'm Krishna's devotee, I'm Krishna's servant. It's just very general. But each of us have a very particular relationship with Krishna. Right? Just like if there's some devotee here you don't know, and I just say, what's your relationship to that devotee? From, oh, wow, they're a devotee and I'm a devotee. We're both devotees. But if it's someone you know, you'll say, oh, that's my friend. Or that's my daughter. Or that's my mother. Or, right? That you have a specific relationship. That's my Bhakti Shastri teacher. Ah, she made me turn in all those exams. So as devotional service matures, your relationship with Krishna becomes specific. Just like, you know, I just get to meet you. Some of you I'm meeting for the first time. And if I get to know you better over some time, our relationship becomes more specific. I can really say, this is my friend. And of course, everyone who's my friend is not my friend in exactly the same way as every other person who's my friend. Each person have a very specific relationship. So as devotional service matures, you start getting a very specific relationship with Krishna. That starts developing. And when that starts developing, you start having activities in terms of that relationship. Right? If you're my friend, you're not my friend just theoretically. If you're my friend, I talk to you, I go places with you, I do things with you, I eat with you, right? I get you gifts. We have some activities in terms of our friendship. So the perfected devotee is engaged in those activities internally. In this world, they're engaged in those activities internally. And we've all had experience of this, again, you know, that some of you right now may be internally engaging activities with somebody else in your mind, although you're sitting here in the class. It happens. You know, you might be thinking about what you did with somebody yesterday or what you're going to be doing with somebody this afternoon. Correct? So we all know how to do that. That's not it. Prabhupada says we already all have a shakti, we just don't have it for the right object. So a difference between the process and the goal is consciousness, how you're doing things. So the beginner is chanting Krishna's name, and then the perfected devotee is chanting Krishna's name, but there's a whole world of difference in how they're chanting Krishna's name. And the perfected devotee is having activities in relationship to their own specific individual relationship with Krishna. And that's going on internally. And of course, at a certain point, when we achieve our spiritual body, that's what's going on. How do you know the specific relationship? If one asks that question, then it hasn't yet arisen. It's something that arises naturally. It's something like when you're a little child, you may think that you're in love with a certain boy. When I was 5, I was convinced I was in love with a little 5-year-old boy in my class. His name was Chris. I don't remember what he looks like, though. Poor little kid. He wanted nothing to do with me. One time I got free tickets to a children's television show. I got 2 free tickets, so I gave him 1. And he really wanted to go, so he took the ticket, but he wouldn't sit next to me in the show. He didn't want anything to do with this little girl who said she was in love with him. Of course, by the time I was 6, I wasn't in love with him anymore. And I have no idea what happened to him. So that sort of thing is not very meaningful. I mean, sometimes people actually marry the person they say they love when they're 5, but usually it doesn't mean very much. Or if a person, when you're 5 or 6, you know, you say, I want to be a fireman, or I want to be a nurse, or I want to be... Again, sometimes a person actually does, but generally, it doesn't mean anything. It usually doesn't mean anything. I want to be a tennis star, or I want to be a rock star, you know, and you're 3 years old, and I want to be an astronaut. Yeah. So usually nobody takes that seriously. Again, there are sometimes people who say when they're 5 years old, I want to do such and such, and that's what they do, but it's not usually like that. Is that correct? You know, when you become mature, then these things naturally develop. An attraction to somebody when you're 16 is very different from an attraction to somebody when you're 5. it's just quite different. And talking about what you want to do when you're 16 is very different than talking about what you want to do when you're 5. Which is bigger when you're 20 or 25. So it's a question of being mature. When you mature, it's a question of being awake. You know, when you wake up, when you first wake up, you may not remember who you are and what you're supposed to do and where you are. Especially if, like me, you travel a lot. You know, when I first wake up, I'm not always sure where I am. Or what time zone it is, or you know, what I'm supposed to do that day. Isn't it the first few minutes when you wake up? You're not fully awake. You're not sure necessarily what day it is or where you are or what you're supposed to do in the day. The scientists say it takes about 20 minutes to fully wake up. And then as you wake up, you're like, oh, okay. Today's Thursday, and I'm supposed to teach the Bhakti Shastri class on the qualities of a devotee, and my name is Urmila, and I'm in Mayapur, and you know. So these things come to you. So as we come to Nista, which is Nista, I was just hearing Prabhupada said 50%. So Nista means that you're somewhat pure. If you look at Madhurya Kadambini, at Nista, the wanting to please Krishna is almost equal to wanting to please yourself. It looks to me like it's 60-40. Looks to me at Nista like it's 60-40. 60 in favor of yourself. But I was just hearing Prabhupada say 50%. So something like that. When you come to Nista, you're basically in the mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance are not disturbing you anymore. At that point, you start to wake up. And start to wake up, then when you, that's like a twilight. Haridas Thakur says that this is when you're chanting on the level of, anybody know? Namabash. Namabash is a shadow. Just another example is early in the morning, we have cones and rods in our eyes, a little science lesson here for you guys. So the cones can see color and the rods can only see black and white. But the rods can function in a lot less light than the cones. The cones need a lot of light to function. So that's why very early in the morning or in the evening, you stop being able to see colors outside. Have you noticed that? The first thing in the morning, notice it next time. Before the sun rises, when there's still enough light, there's just enough light to see, everything just looks like shades of gray. You can't make out, the trees don't look green. They just look black. So you can see the outlines of things, but you can't see the colors and you can't see the finer details of things. So that's Namabhas. So Haridas Thakura said that's the sun hasn't risen yet. The sun really hasn't risen, but it's come close enough to the horizon that you can see something. So that's like you're starting to wake up. You're still in bed. You haven't gotten out of bed. You haven't actually started to do anything yet, but you're starting to wake up. You know, what time is it? Where am I? What day is today? So at then you actually wake up. Then you come to your activity. So generally, it says that at the stage of a shakti, one starts to get the seed of one's relationship with Krishna. That's like you're actually out of bed and you're walking around. You know, the sun's actually come up. Of course, one thing is that just like yesterday we were talking about the Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama. Y'all remember that? Y'all remember the 9 squares we drew on the flip chart? Everybody, can you picture that in your mind from yesterday? So remember that I was saying that the Kanista of one system doesn't connect with the Kanista of another system? That they're describing different things? And therefore you can't say that if someone's a Kanista Adhikari that they're going to have the symptoms of all 3 descriptions. So, and I talked about this earlier also, that people advance in different levels, in different things. It's not that a person becomes a... Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about this in terms of body, mind, and words. And he says, usually, first you advance in body, and then words, and then mind. So first your body is steady, then your words are steady, then your mind is steady. But he says sometimes it may go in a different order. And he also talks about being steadiness in bhakti and being steadiness in the qualities of bhakti, which is what we're looking at today. What are the qualities of bhakti? And he said, generally, First you become steady in the qualities, and then you become steady in bhakti. But sometimes, he says, you become steady in bhakti, but you haven't yet become steady in the qualities, which is why you can find someone who's fixed in bhakti but who's still arrogant. Interesting. And he said, if someone's steady in the qualities but not steady in bhakti, you don't consider that they're at nista. But if someone's steady in bhakti, even if they're not steady in the qualities, you consider that they're at nista. Anyway, because different people mature at different rates in different things, you can't make an absolute distinction. This only happens at this stage and this only happens at this stage. It's just not the way life is. It's like you can't say that every 8-year-old child is going to be able to do this and not be able to do that. And you can't say that everyone at a certain level of physical maturity is going to have a certain level of intellectual maturity. They might or they might not. Some people become intellectually mature before they become physically mature, and some people become physically mature before they become intellectually mature. That's probably more common. But there's definitely, it's different for different people. So a person can have some glimpse of their relationship with Krishna, even at an earlier stage. That happens. And there's also Krishna as a person. So always remember, this is not a mechanical process. It's not a mechanical process. Krishna is a person. And he as a person can reciprocate with devotees as he likes. And he can give people a hint of their awakened state. Just like sometimes, you know, you may wake up in the middle of the night. You ever wake up in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Everybody's sometimes woken up in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're immediately wide awake in the middle of the night. Hasn't that happened? Mm-hmm. You've never been wide awake in the middle of the night? We'll come pour water on you today. But sometimes it happens. You know, you wake up at 1 in the morning and you're completely wide awake, and 5 minutes later you're sleeping again. Or you can wake up in the middle of the night partially. You wake up, look at the clock. It's only 12:30 and you're going back to bed. And you don't fully wake up. So even the neophyte devotee has glimpses of ecstasy, isn't it? Even the beginning devotee has glimpses of some level of spiritual happiness sometimes. So that can also be there. That doesn't mean you immediately decide, oh, I must be experiencing prema because I had some glimpse of something. So as far as when does one know one's relationship with Krishna, generally the seed of that comes at a shakti. So there's nista, then ruchi, then a shakti. Nista means you're in the mode of goodness almost completely. Almost all the inartas are gone. Then ruchi means you have such a taste for chanting. Prabhupada said, you know that you're at that stage when 16 rounds isn't enough. You want to chant 16,000 rounds. You have a taste for the service. And a shakti is you become very attached to Krishna, the person. Ruchi, you're very attached to the service. A shakti, you're very attached to Krishna. In a shakti, your mind automatically thinks of Krishna. So before a shakti, even at nista and ruchi, you can be chanting or looking at the deities and all of a sudden you think about something else. This is all from Madhurya Kadambini, by the way. But at a shakti, even if someone's talking about politics or the news or whatever, you'll start thinking about Krishna. So at a shakti, you'll start thinking about Krishna as automatically as somebody below a shakti starts thinking about Maya. Below a shakti, even at nista and ruchi, you're thinking about Krishna, you're reading Bhagavad Gita, you're reading Krishna book, you're talking about Krishna, and all of a sudden, you're thinking, is that purple sari clean? I want to wear it tomorrow. Or something. Right? Something. And you're like, how did that happen? I was meditating on, you know, Krishna killing this demon or something. And all of a sudden I'm thinking about something else. So at a shakti goes the opposite. That someone's saying, oh, you know, can we get these saris? And all of a sudden you're like, yeah, Radharani wears such a nice sari. And it just happens naturally. And it happens pretty much all the time. So at that stage is generally when the seed of one's eternal relationship with Krishna starts to manifest. But it can sometimes manifest to a lesser extent, little glimpses before that. That is possible. That is possible. And how will you know? It's just, that's like saying, how will you know that you love somebody? You know. Or Prabhupada says, how do you know you've eaten? You don't have to check. Excuse me, did I just eat enough or do I need to eat more? Says you don't need to take a certificate from somebody else. Can I get a certificate from you saying that I've eaten enough? But you naturally feel satisfaction, nourishment, and relief from hunger by eating. So you just know. Oh, okay. Yes.
If it's so important to come to the mode of goodness, like you're saying at Nishtha, then it's from society, like so much services are there, so many, and it's so strongly encouraged to strongly get involved.
Okay, can we all go back? This is a very good point. Can we all go back a little bit? I drew something on the flip chart about the three modes of nature, and I talked about actions and motives. Does anybody remember that? What's one of the big differences between goodness and passion?
The action is the same, but the consciousness.
Generally, the action is the same or similar. There are some actions that are really just in goodness and some that are just in passion. But really, the actions are generally very, very similar. If you go through the lists of the modes of nature, which I think we have some charts in here, don't we? Yeah, we do. Some things are different. I mean, foods are different, for example. So there are some things that are different. But like if you look at page 83, if you look at sacrifices, you'll notice the only difference between goodness and passion is the mentality. Whereas when you look at ignorance, there's actually some difference in the externals. Page 83. Same with austerities. Sacrifices, austerity, and charity, the only difference is the mentality. Now when you go to ignorance, you start finding that there's actually a difference in the externals. If you look even at action, because you're talking specifically about action. Now, you might say in passion, Prabhupada says Krishna says great endeavor. But Prabhupada makes the point in 1422. Let's read what Prabhupada says in 1422. This is a long introduction to the topic, but is this interesting?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, in 1422 to 25, bottom of the page in my book, it's the end of the second paragraph of the purport to 1422-25. He does not attempt anything for his own sake. He can attempt anything for Krishna, but for his personal self, he does not attempt anything. And we talked about that a little bit. What does that mean for your personal self? You do not attempt anything. So this idea of great endeavor, the great endeavor of passion is a great endeavor to satisfy your senses and that of false ego. It's not that the person in goodness necessarily doesn't make any great endeavor. Even a person in material goodness may be making a great endeavor to understand philosophy. Prabhupada says they're a philosopher, a poet, or a scientist. They may be making a great endeavor to discover some scientific truth. They may be making a great endeavor to write poetry. They may be making a great endeavor for studying philosophy. Or they may be making a great endeavor for liberation. The desire for liberation is in the mode of goodness. So the fact that someone's making a great endeavor does not automatically put it in passion. I wish I could remember this, or I had my computer with me, but neither of them is the fact. Bhaktivinoda Thakur does define how in Krishna consciousness, what are some of the things that tell you that the great endeavor is in the mode of passion, externally? I don't remember what they are. He gives a list of about three or four. Maybe I'll remember to look it up, and maybe I'll be able to find it easily, which is another question. if I copied and pasted it into my nectar folder, I'll be able to find it easily. If not, I may not. But he gives a list.
It'd be really helpful.
Yeah, it would be. It would be, that would be a helpful thing for me to have memorized, wouldn't it?
Mm.
It's a really helpful list. I can't even remember where he says it, but I know it's Bhaktivinoda. And it's a list of 3 to 5 things that he says, you know, if you're doing this even in Krishna consciousness, then that's an improper endeavor. Most of the time what we're looking at is what is our motive. What is our motive? Other indications, some other external indications of power. Oh, as far as what is our motive, a warning for you would be, as you advance in Krishna consciousness, you'll notice that your motives are mostly rotten. So when you first come, you think your motives are wonderful. And gradually you'll start noticing, my motives are really rotten. I think I'm doing this to please Guru and Krishna, but actually I'm just doing it for my own sense gratification and my own ego and my own this and my own that. And it's, I will warn you that most likely the things that are the most nasty are the things you think that are the nicest. So like when I write articles for Back to Godhead, generally the sentence or the paragraph that I think is the best in the whole paper is exactly what the other editors say to get rid of. It's like, that's just a jewel of poetry. Anyway, so it's often the things we're doing in Krishna consciousness that we often think, well, this is just, I know I have so many faults, but this thing, I really got it. That's probably something that's rotten. Just so now you feel very enlivened. And often the response of the devotee, which was Arjuna's response to noticing this, is to want to stop the activity. So Arjuna said, wait a minute, I'm noticing that my reasons for fighting are not very good. So why should I fight? And Krishna says, no, don't change your behavior, change your consciousness. So there's a strong tendency for us to just say, oh, I realize that the only reason I'm going to Mangalartik is so everybody can think I'm a great devotee. I'm not going to Mangalartik because I want to see Krishna, I want to please Guru. I'm just going so everybody else will notice I'm at Mangalartik. Oh, look, she's at Mangalartik. She must be very advanced.
To fill all sadhana sheets.
Yeah, to fill out your sadhana sheets. And then you think, well, you know, now I just won't go to Mangalartik anymore. Like, I know one devotee who's not much of a devotee anymore, unfortunately. She said, you know, whenever I go to the temple, I just criticize the devotee, so better I don't go to the temple. And gradually she started giving up her Krishna consciousness. So that's also a little trick of Maya. That Maya says, you're doing this for the wrong reason. And we go, oh, okay, well then I won't do it anymore. Instead of, no, why don't you start doing it for the right reason? Some external signs of the mode of passion that I personally notice are when, remember we talked about ordinary, desired, and emergency activities? Prabhupada mm-hmm. talks about that in the Gita purport. If you're always doing emergency activities, that's a good sign that the mode of passion or ignorance is operative. In other words, if you're not generally working according to your nature. Also, Krishna says one who's temperate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all pangs by practice of the yoga system. If your life isn't balanced, that's another really good clue. You know, you're not getting enough sleep, or you're getting too much sleep. You're not eating the right things, or you're eating too much, or you're not eating enough. You're getting sick. Of course, you can get sick even if you're responsible, but getting sick due to being irresponsible. Those are some signs that, but just working hard by itself is not necessarily a sign of the mode of passion. Prabhupada would often talk about how Hanuman and Arjuna were fighting and working hard. Prabhupada certainly worked hard. So working really hard for Krishna is not indicative of the mode of passion at all. But if you're working hard for your false ego, then you're in trouble. And one way you can tell that is your life is way out of balance.
Can I just check if you upload
That's a good sign that you're not in the mode of goodness. Because Krishna says a yogi is someone who's temperate in eating, sleeping, working, recreation. Doesn't he say that? Does he say that? He does say that, right? Okay. And he says you can't be a yogi if you eat too much or eat too little, sleep too much, or do not sleep enough. So if your life is way out of balance, like there's that letter where some devotee complained about having to take care of her children. She just wanted to do deity worship. She actually wanted to give her child away to somebody else so she could worship the deities. Prabhupada said, for you, child worship is more important than deity worship. He said, for you, child worship is more important than deity worship. He said, these are not ordinary children. They're Vaikuntha children. And Prabhupada told Lakshmi Moni, though I can't find it in the Vedabase, but she told me personally that he wrote her this. He said, you know, the woman should always take care of her children and her household duties like she takes care of her bunch of hair. So like the woman will never let her hair get messy. So, you know, you don't. He said, you have to have some common sense. Don't do one thing at the expense of another. So you see, I mean, that to me is also a very clear sign. Somebody whose personal life is just a catastrophe field. They're doing all kinds of service. Their room is filthy. You know, they're too busy doing service to clean their room. They're too busy doing service to spend time with their children. They're too busy doing service to spend time with their husband. They're too busy doing service to eat with meditation. Prabhupada used to eat very meditatively. They're too busy doing service to cultivate any kind of relationship with devotees. Oh, can I tell you a Christian story? Is that all right? Mm-hmm. Is that acceptable? You won't report me? And then we'll take a break and then we'll go over and then we'll do the qualities. So there was this one, this is a true story. There was a Christian minister, and he was a really hard-working Christian minister. And he was due to get gallbladder surgery. He was going to have his gallbladder removed. And he felt very fearful about the surgery. First of all, he was just afraid something would go wrong. It was a small hospital. But also he said that he was worried that he would be away from his responsibilities for too long. He thought, you know, I'm so busy in the church, I do so many things, I don't want to be away from my work for so long. And he just, you know, he was completely in anxiety. So while the surgery was going on, they told him, don't worry about it. It was one of those things, one of those new surgeries where they make a tiny little cut and they thread something into your body instead of making a big cut. So they thread it in, and then at the end of this thing, whatever it is, there's a little tiny knife, and they operate it with like robots. So you have a faster recovery time because they're not cutting so much stuff. So as they were threading this thing, somehow it malfunctioned. And it cut one of the main blood vessels in his body. So he was bleeding to death internally. And it took the doctors a long time to even figure out what was happening. You know, he started dying, but because they couldn't see, they didn't know what was happening. So he had what's called an out-of-body experience or a near-death experience when his body died. And, you know, his body was dead for something like 10 minutes or something like that. So he's floating out of his body. And as he's floating out of his body, he's watching the doctors try to save his body. And as often happens with these sort of experiences, he felt very detached from his body. Some people who have out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, will just look and say, boy, that person looks like they're in bad shape. They lose their bodily identification. So he felt very, very detached from what was going on. He was just sort of interested in looking at them trying to save his body. And then he hears a voice, and he said, I knew it was God. And he said, if you ask me how I knew, he said, all I'll tell you is I just know. He said it was something like having a million of your closest friends all combined into one voice. He said, and the voice said, Steve, don't worry, it'll all be okay. And he thought, wow, God knows my name. And then the voice says to him, so Steve, how many hours a week do you work? Oh, wow. He said, Lord, I work about 100 hours a week. And then the voice says to him, from now on, I want you to be a turtle instead of a rabbit.
Wow. Slow down.
And then when he tells a story, he said, now just stick with me. It gets even weirder. That's what he says when he's writing this story. He says, then the voice says to me, by the way, what are the names of your friends, of your children's friends? What are the names? I think he had three children. What are the names of your children's friends? And he said, you know, you can't lie to God. He said, I had to say, I don't know any of their names. Anyway, then meanwhile, while this is going on, he's seeing the doctors try to fix his body. At a certain point, you know, they get really desperate and they just cut him open. And there was some doctor who was leaving the hospital, was walking out of the hospital, and he heard the code blue, and he rushes there, and he's the only person in that whole county who knew how to deal with this. And anyway, they sewed up the blood vessel, and they saved him. And he said that he wasn't really fully in his body after that for a while. Well, he went through the recovery, he said he wasn't, like, completely in his body. And he said, God didn't talk to me anymore, but I felt him for a long time. And he said, even the recovery process was part of my new learning, that I just couldn't run around and do things anymore. He said, just this long, slow recovery, because when there hadn't been any blood, a lot of his organs had started shutting down, and it eventually made a full recovery. He said, now I only work 35 hours a week, and I know the names of all my children's friends. He said, one thing that he could really see when he was out of his body like that was that all of his actions were motivated by ego. He said, when he was out of his body and Krishna was talking to him, they said, I could realize that I was no different than somebody trying to run a business to make money. That my consciousness, my motive, my ego wasn't any different. So does that help? Sometimes busyness can be a kind of intoxication also. You keep so busy that you never think. You don't think about what you're doing and who you are and what your motives are, and you never become introspective. Prabhupada says we should all be independently thoughtful. So sometimes we can be so busy that we never become thoughtful. If you never have time to read Prabhupada's books, I mean, that's another real sign. That's a big problem. You know, so if you're so busy that you don't know the names of your children's friends, and you never can read Prabhupada's books, and you know, you're never meditating on prasadam, your room is a mess because you never have time to clean it because you're so busy doing service. Your own health is falling apart because you never have time to take care of your health. Those are some good signs. External signs that probably your motives are off. Or, you know, you just get in your own head, I'm just gonna do this thing. You don't consult with anybody. Or you consult with people and they say, no, don't do this. No, I'm gonna do this. This is a sign of my surrender. You know, that's another good indication that it's the mode of passion. You don't have the choice.
It's like when you're married to a husband.
I hope you're married to husbands. Sorry, you never, I couldn't. You just handed that one to me. Well, first of all, as far as choice, I know I said this before, there's only two things you don't have a choice about. What are the two things you have no choice about?
Death and taxes.
No, you don't die. Na hanyate hanyamane shivire. And you can get away with not paying taxes if you're clever enough. You don't have a choice about whether or not to exist. You have to exist.
Yeah.
So the opposite of death. You have to exist. You can't die. You can never die. You can never say, I choose to die. Can't do it. Doesn't work. You can kill your body, but that doesn't work because you're not the body. So you can't die. You can be in unconscious state for a while, but you can't die. And you have to serve. We're designed to be givers, not takers. So we have to be giving to something and we have to exist. Everything else is a choice. 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 And if you do something out of a feeling of obligation and you don't really want to do it, that's the mode of?
Passion.
That doesn't mean you should necessarily change your behavior, but it means you might have to think about what's your motive. And you might change some of your behavior. If the only reason I'm doing something is that I feel obligated, then either I need to reassess why I'm doing it, or I need to not do it. I was talking to one devotee whose mother was visiting her, a non-devotee mother. And she said, oh, my mother wants me to, it was from a foreign country. She said, my mother wants me to take her around the city and show her the sights, and I really don't want to. I just feel obligated. I'm feeling resentful that I don't want to go. I said, well, are you going to go or not? She said, yeah, I'm going to go. He said, well, if you're going to go, then you're choosing to go. And if you're choosing to go, it must be because you want something. I said, do you want to have a nice relationship with your mother? Yes. Do you want to spend time with your mother? Yes. Do you want to make your mother happy? Yes. All right, now you might not choose to go to, you know, whatever it was, the Sydney Opera House, or I forget where it was. You might not choose to do that, but you're saying, I choose to go to the park because I want to make my mother happy and have a good relationship with my mother and please my mother. So my suggestion is that the things in your life where you feel obligated to stop and say, why am I choosing to? First of all, admit that you're choosing it. So the first thing is to admit that I'm choosing it. And the second thing is, why am I choosing it? I'm choosing it because I want a nice relationship with my husband, because I want my husband to be happy, because I want Krishna to be pleased, because I want to follow the Shastra, because I want to follow my guru. Or I'm choosing to do this because I like to honor my commitments, and I said I would do it, and I want to be an honest person, and I want to be a reliable person, and I want to be a responsible person. If you see that some of your choices are really messing up your life, then you may have to reevaluate your choices and say, wait a minute, this isn't working. You know, I've got to make some kind of an adjustment here. I'm only sleeping 3 hours a night and I'm falling asleep walking, and you know, I can't function like this. I'm only having time to wash my hair once every 2 months, you know, and that's just not working anymore for me. See, you've got to, I know one devotee lady who has hair like down to here, and it's extremely curly. And so it literally takes her an hour to comb her hair. And so sometimes she doesn't comb her hair for a month. She just keeps putting it up. I say, you got to comb your hair at least once a week. Sometimes her husband says, if you're not going to comb it, cut it off. But if you start seeing that, you know, my life's really out of balance, then you have to make a change. The main thing you want to ask yourself is, am I thinking about Krishna? Am I connecting with Krishna? That's the main thing you want to look at. But there was one devotee here in Mayapur who... His wife was telling me. He was a very, very talented devotee. Extremely talented, and talented in an area where there weren't a lot of other talented people. So, you know, if you're a very talented cook, maybe there's another 20 talented cooks in the community. But sometimes a person is the only person in the community who has their particular talent. So that was the case with this devotee. And so he was working 7 days a week. He said 7 days a week, probably 12 to 15 hours a day.
Whoa.
And after about 10 years of that, he left.
Yeah.
And when he left, he said, I don't know who I am anymore. I never do anything for me. And he's tried to come back. He's kind of come back and left and come back and left and come back and left and come back and left. So that's not surrender. There's emergency, desired, and ordinary activities, and there's a balanced, temperate life. So that's also part of our service, is to keep our sanity, to sometimes do desired activities. One of the pieces of advice that I give to devotees is, if you really want to stay in Krishna consciousness your whole life, make sure you also have desired activities in Krishna consciousness. Make sure you don't only do emergency activities. Make sure you're mostly doing ordinary activities that are your nature, and also have some desired activities. Have some things you do in Krishna consciousness that you like to do, that you're not doing them because anybody asked you to do them. Maybe you're just doing them because you like to do them. Whatever it may be, you know, you're embroidering an outfit for your own deities, or you're growing a little garden, or you're writing a little book of poetry, or whatever it is. And you may not be able to work on it every day, but something that you like. And in a similar way, some kind of recreation that's connected with Krishna. Krishna says, you know, temperate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation. Recreation. So recreation is recreation. It's like I have batteries in this thing. Every once in a while, I have to recharge the batteries. I can't just run them all the time. And that was one of Prabhupada's reasons for wanting the devotees to come to Mayapur every year. Prabhupada wanted everyone in the movement to come to Mayapur every year. And that was, you know, one of the main reasons he gave, was as a way of recharging, to have spiritual recreation. I think it was Dhananjayapur who talked about this, how he flew to India to see Prabhupada to ask him some managerial question. And then he was going to fly back. And Prabhupada said, no, stay here for 3 weeks. So that's very important. I'd say ideally sometime every day, sometime every week, sometime every month, and sometime every year, where you're doing something that's recreation. And try to connect it with Krishna. That would be nice. Not like, well, okay, once a year I'll go to the movies. You know? But have your recreation, something that has to do with Krishna.
You can also watch the devotional movie and eat popcorns.
Watch a devotional movie and eat popcorns. You know? Read a devotional book that's not on your, you know, your list of systematic reading. I mean, you may be systematically reading through the Bhagavatam, but maybe sometimes you just want to read, you know, Chaitanya Bhagavat stories. That's your fun. Everybody has different fun. You have to decide what your fun is. I know one devotee who makes these really creative videos where she writes her own songs, her own Krishna conscious songs, and then makes videos and puts them on YouTube. You know, like rap music even, to all Krishna conscious lyrics, and they're really clever. Whatever, you know, whatever you like to do, but have it be something that you like to do, that you enjoy. And one devotee I know who's very, who's visiting Mayapur right now, who's very, very successful materially, told me that what he does is at least once in a month, he goes for like one day. Of course, you can't do this if you're a housewife and a mother. He says once a month he goes away for like up to 3 days and doesn't even tell anyone where he's going, doesn't take his cell phone, doesn't take his laptop. He's a big businessman. And he says he just does, you know, hearing and chanting for 2 to 3 days a month. So that's my strong recommendation. There should be a little time, ideally every day. Ideally, every day you have a little time that's, you know, something that you like to do. And some days it's not going to happen. I mean, there's just going to be some days when it won't happen. And then sometime every week, and sometime in a month, and sometime in a year, when you're doing something that you like to do. And even if you have small children, you know, there's other people in the community who can watch your children for an hour. If you're watching your own children 24/7, you're going to go stark raving mad. I don't care how nice of children they are, you know. Sometimes a husband can watch them, or your mother, or your auntie, or somebody can watch them. And maybe sometimes your husband can eat at Govinda's. Oh, he can cook if you're lucky. The only thing my husband cooked until he became a vinyaprasta was popcorn. Somehow now he's learned how to cook. Now he does all this microwave cooking. He writes his recipes up on the internet, all this microwave. But you know, sometimes he can eat at the feast or at Govinda's or something. We used to have once a week where we would eat it in Detroit. Once a week we eat at the temple restaurant. I didn't have to cook. That's nice. Mm-hmm. If you're in an extended family, probably some days your mother-in-law cooks. Or some days your auntie cooks. You know, in a village, the women got off 3 days a month. Mm-hmm. You know, you might think, oh, well, that was denigrating women. No, it wasn't. She had 3 days off a month.
Especially in a certain moment, it's really good.
That's very nice, you know. And then no one's expecting you to cook or clean or do laundry, and you can have some private time for yourself. It's especially important for women because they say a man works from sun to sun, but a woman's work is never done. Is never done. You wash the dishes, and somehow or other, there's new dirty dishes in the sink. You do the laundry and somehow there's more dirty clothes to wash, right? So it's sort of perpetual. Most women's work, you don't get to a point you say, ah, I've done. So it's nice to have some break. So that's my suggestion. If you really want long-term, if you want to be here long-term, if you don't want to just, you know, be a real enthusiastic devotee for a few years and then we don't see you anymore. And you say, oh, that Krishna consciousness was too hard. So that's not surrender. It may look like surrender, but it's not surrender. That's probably the mode of passion and ego. You know, I'm going to work so hard that I ruin my health and I can't clean my house. And I never have any time to do for Krishna the things that I would like to do. What's really nice is if you have desired activities that nobody else even gives you a pat on the back for. That has nothing to do with acclaim and just your own little thing. You're growing your own little tomatoes in your own little garden, you know.
And that's also working for Krishna because somehow Krishna gave us the capacity to do these things.
Of course. Of course it's for Krishna. Somebody had their hand raised over there.
I was going to ask a question if it's not helpful to the rest of the group, and maybe you can answer it like outside of class. As we're
has this been helpful to everybody?
Yes.
Yeah, happy.
Yes.
Yes.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, if you think that the answer to this question won't be helpful, then maybe just go on. So, like, when we're doing service and associating with devotees and chanting, and then, you know, we realize that our motives kind of suck, and more and more we realize, wow, our motives really, really suck.
Just wait.
Okay.
Just wait. It'll get worse.
Oh my God.
It will.
But how do you tolerate that without just being absorbed and like thinking badly about yourself? Because then it's not thinking about Krishna. It's just like
that's. Are you all interested in that question?
Yes.
I think that's
like, God, I really suck and I hate myself and I have all these horrible.
Okay. Well, now that what mode is that?
That's ignorance.
That is a mode of ignorance, because you happen to be a part of
Krishna.
If you hate yourself, guess what?
You're hating Krishna.
You're hating Krishna.
What about low self-esteem?
In fact, part of the reason that we're here is self-hatred. Because who are we? We're servants. We hate the fact that we're servants. We really hate it. I don't want to be a servant. I want to be the master. I don't have to be a servant. So there's a lot of self-hatred involved with being materially conditioned. But that's not, you know, let's say that you were guiding somebody to do something. What's something you're really good at? Some skill that you're good at. Art. Okay. So let's say I came to you and I say, okay, Tess, would you teach me how to draw? So you're teaching me, and did you ever see Jadarati's early paintings? Yeah. Anybody ever see them? They were not very good. You find Jadarani's early paintings. So let's say I did that, and I said, you know, that's really not very good. I guess I'm just not any good at this. I really just don't have any talent. Would you be happy with that as a teacher? No. No. You would find it actually disgusting. So Krishna's not happy with that. But I'll tell you what it can be like, and then we'll take a break. So, does everyone here, have you all had at least once in your life a good friend or a close family member? Well, you're laughing, because I said this to someone the other day, and they told me they'd never had a good friend. Said this to someone the other day. Have you ever had a good friend? They said, no, I've never had a close friend. So I'm hoping everyone here has had at least one close friend or one close family member, someone that you were really, really, really close to. So let's say you hurt that person. Let's say you cheated that person somehow. You did something really nasty. I mean, like really, really nasty. You know, like someone who cheats on their spouse or something. You know, maybe you really had a nice relationship with your husband and then you ran off to have an affair with another man. You do something really, really nasty. Or you went around to other people saying nasty things about your friend. You know, you said, oh, yeah, she's like this and she's like that and she's like this, and your friend got to hear about it. And your relationship is now damaged. Actually, it's so damaged that you're not speaking. But generally, when we have a relationship that's so damaged that we're not speaking, we generally think it's the other person's fault. Or we think it's both of our faults. But usually we focus on how it's the other person's fault. So in this world, most of us are very angry at Krishna. You know, when we're suffering, I was just talking to one devotee whose child just had a really horrific situation. And she was saying, you know, one of the first things we think is, why does Krishna do this to me? Why is Krishna making me suffer like this? So we generally blame Krishna for the fact that our relationship is broken. Why has Krishna put me in this world? I couldn't possibly have fallen from the spiritual world. You know, why did Krishna let me break my foot? You know, why did Krishna let my husband leave me or my house burn down or whatever it is? So usually you're angry at Krishna. And as you advance in Krishna consciousness, you start seeing that the fault is in you. And you'll see deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper that the fault is in you. And not only that the fault is in you, but that the fault is only in us. That it's not in Krishna at all. As we advance in Krishna consciousness, we'll start to see that Krishna is wonderful. And that the only person who broke this relationship is me. That Krishna didn't do anything to break the relationship. In fact, Krishna keeps trying to reestablish it. And the only person who broke it is me. So now, once you realize that the fault is all yours, first of all, that's very embarrassing. It's really, 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 really embarrassing and humiliating and somewhat depressing that the whole responsibility for my being here in material consciousness and in a material body with all of the suffering that I have. Have we all had a lot of suffering? Everybody here has a lot of suffering. You've made a pile of your suffering. I met one devotee who told me she's had no suffering in her life. But my God. You know, this is like this barn full of suffering. And what to speak of in other lifetimes? You know, just in this lifetime, if I think of how much suffering I've had. And if you really look at it and you, wow, that's all my responsibility, every bit of it. And you start to see how much you've hurt other living entities, how much pain we've caused to other living entities, and how much pain you've caused to Krishna. So one way to deal with that is to just sort of run away from that whole thing and not want to face how bad it is. And I think getting depressed about it is a funny way of running away from it. It's like here's your friend's house and you're sitting outside the door just crying at what a lousy friend you are. But if you really realize you've been a lousy friend, what do? You knock on the door and you apologize. So if you're just sitting on the stairs outside the house saying, well, I really blew this whole relationship. My God. I'm really bad. That's not the point. That's not the point. The point is that you knock on the door and you go to your friend and you say, I realize that it was all me. In this world, it's never all me. If I have a problem with you, it's not going to be all me. It's going to be something on both sides, generally, 99% of the time. But in this case, it is all me. So if it becomes part of our saying we're sorry, then it becomes part of loving Krishna and thinking about Krishna. If I'm talking to Krishna about it, rather than just sitting on the front step meditating on myself, which, as far as I can see, another way of getting away from taking responsibility. And it's not that Krishna wants us to be lamenting, and he just wants us to take responsibility. I mean, just think about how you feel. I was dealing with one devotee who really did some nasty things to me. And I've just never been able to get this person to admit that they did what they did. And every once in a while I try, if circumstances permit. So I was saying to this devotee, you know, it would be really nice if you would take responsibility. And this person said to me, are you trying to make me feel guilty? I said, no, I would just like it if you would take responsibility. Have you ever had somebody who hurt you that you just wouldn't take responsibility for it?
You just want a sense of justice, and you just want them to be better.
You want a sense of justice, you want them to be better, and I think mostly what you want is for them to understand how you feel,
yeah,
or how you felt.
Yes, yes.
I think that's mostly what you want.
Yeah,
mostly you want to be understood.
Yeah, that's
mostly you want the person to say, wow, when I did that, when I said that, whatever, you must have felt really hurt. You must have been in a lot of pain. It must have caused you a lot of grief. And if somebody empathizes with us, we very easily let it all go. But if someone comes to us and they say, oh, I'm really, 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 really sorry. Like children do that. You know, the child hits their brother over the head with a fire truck, toy fire truck. And you say, you shouldn't have done that. Say you're sorry now. Well, until you say you're sorry, you're going to have to stand in the corner. You know, and then finally, they come out and say, I'm sorry. Now, look at your brother when you say that. I'm sorry. You know, and then usually you just say, okay, all right, go play again, you know. But that's not what Krishna's looking for. You know, it needs to be where you really understand, what did we do to Krishna? And the main thing that we did to Krishna was something we did to ourselves. If someone that you love becomes a heroin addict and becomes a thief and is lying in the street in their vomit, what's hurting you is what they're doing to themselves. It may not be really hurting you. It may not be affecting your personal life at all. But when you think about what they're doing to them to themselves, it causes you pain. And that's the pain that we're causing Krishna. So when we look at these things in ourselves, at what's happening, as we're chanting and doing service, the dust from the mirror is getting removed, and we're starting to see ourselves. And at first we see, in one sense, the false self. We see the self that's become lusty and envious and greedy and arrogant. And we see that by doing these things, the main person I've hurt is myself. In one sense, I can't really hurt any other living entity because everybody is only getting the results of their own actions. So in one sense, I'm only the agent for somebody else's suffering. I can't do anything to you that you really haven't done to yourself. I can be the agent for your getting back what you've done to yourself. And I certainly can't really hurt Krishna, but I can hurt myself. So I've really, really hurt myself. And that's caused Krishna pain. He's sad about that. He's grieving that I've caused him pain. And because I want to love him, therefore I feel sorry. That here's my best friend as that minister was saying, like thousands or millions of your best friends all talking at once. You know, here's my very best friend, and I've caused my best friend pain. Here's my best friend who's willing to give me anything, including himself, and I've slapped him in the face. So I'm thinking about it in relationship to him, not in relationship to how bad I feel. I mean, you'll also find when people have done things to hurt you, often the reason that they apologize is so that they'll get something. You know, the little kid wants to be able to play again. So if the reason we're apologizing is so we can get liberated, so we can get out of the corner, you know, or so I can enjoy in the spiritual world or something. But that's not what it's all about. It's so I can have my relationship back. So this revealing of our lack of these qualities that we're going to discuss hopefully today, our this revealing of how we don't have these qualities, how we have the demoniac qualities, is a way for us to say, oh, yeah, I take responsibility. I did this, nobody else, not Krishna, not my parents, not, you know, I did it. And I did, I'm doing it. It's not just something I did millions and millions of years ago. I made a foolish decision millions and millions of years ago, and now I'm an innocent victim. But I'm making that decision every moment. I'm making the decision now to act on the platform of false ego and do things just so that people will praise me, or just so I'll get some nice prasadam, or so I can think of myself as a righteous person or as a very spiritual person or whatever it is. Or just to show that I'm better than somebody else, or just to make someone else suffer. And Krishna is showing all that to us so that we can have a deep repentance as part of reestablishing the relationship. You know, if your husband cheats on you with another woman, and he just comes back and says, you know, okay, you got to take me back now. Here I am. I won't do it again. I know one guy that cheated on his wife. And he came back and he, you know, it took a while. It wasn't like he could reestablish the relationship in a day. Prabhupada says Krishna wants to see how painstaking we are. And what he needed to do was understand how she felt. He said, you must have felt really scared that I was going to leave you. Or really scared that I didn't love you anymore, that I wasn't going to take care of you anymore. And he felt really angry at me. He said, I was just a jerk. I was an idiot. It was a fit of insanity. I feel so bad that I hurt you. God, I'd love it if some of the people who've done things to me would say that to me, you know? I really would. That would be so nice. I mean, I recently had somebody circulate a paper on a philosophical topic, and it mentioned my name, and it said three nasty things about me, none of which are true. And I brought it up to this devotee, and I said, you know, you just circulated this paper that says nasty things about me. He said, oh, really? I didn't know that was in there. I never read it. Oh. And he said, Prabhu, why are you sending out electronically? I said, how many people did you send it to? He said, I'm not going to tell you, that violates my privacy. Okay. I said, who did you send it to? I'm not going to tell you, that violates my privacy. I said, Prabhu, how could you send out a paper to maybe dozens of people without even reading it? He said, I didn't want to say anything bad about you. I said, well, do something about it. He said, well, you know, I just didn't know. Like that, and that was it. Just, well, I didn't know. And what am I looking for? I'm looking for him to say, oh, really? That was really irresponsible of me to send people a paper without reading it myself and seeing what was in it. That was really foolish of me. You must have felt really, you know, frightened or irritated or upset that some friend of yours is sending out a paper criticizing you and saying false things about you. I wish you would say that. You know, he just won't. Now, to say those kind of things requires what? Humility. Therefore, humility, according to Bhaktivinoda and Bhajanarahasya, humility is the door to nishta. That's the gateway. And humility is just, you know, what have I done? What am I doing? What am I doing to Krishna? And part of your relationship with Krishna. It's kind of like, you know, you go back in your friend's house and you sit down next to your friend and you give them a hug and you say, I'm really sorry. I'm really, really sorry. I went around to our mutual friends saying bad things about you. I caused you problems in the community. You know, you must have felt really, really hurt because you trusted me and I turned against you. I badmouthed you, but whatever it is. Please forgive me. You know, I don't have any excuse. That's the other thing, when people make excuses. Isn't that awful? It's awful. Oh, I'm so sorry I did that. But, you know, that's just the way I was raised and I just can't help it. And you're like, well, and you're thinking, are you sorry or not? Isn't it? Or, oh, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I'm just a terrible person. I should just never see you again. I should just leave Mayapur and stop chanting even. I'm so fallen. That's not what I wanted. So, but if the person could just come and say, well, I really caused you a problem. And I caused you a problem because of my own selfishness and my own stupidity and my own foolishness, and I really caused you hurt. And I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be like that anymore. I like what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I really don't like this worldly life anymore. He doesn't mean birth, death, old age, and disease. He means I don't like being envious of you, Krishna. I don't like hurting you anymore. I want our relationship back. And I know I don't deserve to have the relationship back. It's not something I can really earn. But I'm begging you, please give me the relationship back. And help me so that I don't do this again. Purify me. The thing we should be asking for is what Prahlad Maharaj said, you know, please, Lord, I want the benediction I want is that within my heart there be no material desires. You know, please remove these motives from my heart, Lord, because I can see that all they're doing is giving me pain and giving you pain. And they're preventing my relationship with you. But to really do that, it requires a lot of humility, because it's very scary to see ourselves honestly. We're terrified that if we see ourselves honestly, we'll get depressed. Or, you know, we'll lose our motive for action. We won't be able to think well of ourselves anymore. But you see, if seeing your faults is part of developing your relationship with Krishna, then you're also seeing something else about yourself. Because if you have a relationship with Krishna, that means you must be what? Pure. You must be spiritual. To have a relationship with Krishna, you must be a soul. Which means you must be forever young, beautiful, powerful, compassionate. All those wonderful qualities Krishna has, we also have them. So if it's part of reestablishing my relationship with Krishna, then it's part of seeing that's there too. I'm a perfect being who's doing something just stupid, just silly, just foolish. It's just foolish. That's all. It's just foolish. This man I know cheated on his wife. He has a wonderful wife. His parents said to him, you know, there's no way you'll ever find a woman as good as your wife. And they're right. She's an incredible wife. She's beautiful. She's devoted. Good housekeeper, good mother, loves him to pieces. Very nice devotee. So we already have the perfect person. And that's just foolish. Why, you know, have an affair with Maya Devi? that make sense? You know, you already got God as your husband, and you want to have an affair with a witch. So you see, it's just foolish. And therefore, humility, real humility. Now we're bridging to our topic. Real humility is the source of great joy. So when the devotees are writing these prayers, you know, I'm a materialistic rascal, always full of lust, they're experiencing great joy. They're experiencing great grief and great joy. If any of you right now have somebody with whom you have a damaged relationship in this world, and just think how much joy it would be if that relationship could be fixed. Like my sister and I didn't speak for 10 years. She wouldn't speak to me. She said, I'm not going to speak to you if you're in the Hare Krishna movement. We didn't fully reestablish our relationship till 3 weeks before she died of cancer. But that was very joyful. She and I had been very, very close when we were young. It was definitely painful for me that she wouldn't speak to me. She didn't want to see me. So that when you reestablish a relationship, it's full of joy. And there's also some grief. Because there's some repentance. Without the repentance, how can you reestablish the relationship? You can't. You can't just walk in and say, here I am, Krishna. Aren't you happy I'm back? We'll say, okay, but we have a few things we have to talk about here. But it's a very joyful thing. And Prabhupada says, any religious system that says you don't have to do any austerity is cheating. And that's the real austerity. That's the real penance. The real penance is to have the humility to see yourself honestly and go to Krishna and say, I really blew it. I really, really blew it. Please help me. I want to come home. Can I come home, please? And he'll say, sure. Why don't you check into a treatment center first? Show me you're serious. Let's see if you can check into the treatment center, do the course of treatment. We'll talk on the phone sometimes. You know? Yeah. After you come from the treatment center, we'll see about having you home again. Because, you know, I mean, last time you were home, you were stealing the money to buy drugs, and it wasn't very nice. So we want to make sure you're cured before you come back home again. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. All right, now we will really take a break. 15 minutes.